When Abram was 99 years old, Yahweh appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. And I will make my covenant between me and you and will make you exceedingly numerous. God said to Abram, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall give rise to nations. Kings of people shall come from her. Then Abram fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, can a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Can Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abram said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live in your sight. God said, no, but your wife Sarah shall bear you a son, and you shall name him Isaac. I shall establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him. As for Ishmael, I have heard of you. I will bless him and make him fruitful and exceedingly numerous. He shall be the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this season next year. Yahweh appeared to Abram by the oaks of Mamre, as he sat at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. He looked up and saw three men standing near him. They said to him, where's your wife Sarah? And he said, there in the tent. Then one said, I will surely return to you in due season, and your wife Sarah shall have a son. And Sarah was listening at the tent entrance behind him. Now Abram and Sarah were old, advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, after I have grown old and my husband is old, shall I have pleasure? Yahweh said to Abram, why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm old? Is anything too wonderful for Yahweh? At the same time, I will return to you in due season, and Sarah shall have a son. But Sarah denied, saying, I didn't laugh, for she was afraid. He said, oh yes, you did laugh. Yahweh dealt with Sarah as he had said, and Yahweh did for Sarah as he had promised. Sarah conceived and bore Abram a son in his old age, at the time of which God had spoken to him. Abram gave the name Isaac to his son, whom Sarah bore him. And Abram circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Abram was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Now Sarah said, God has brought laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And she said, who would ever have said to Abram that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. Some Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to Jesus and asked him a question, saying, Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, leaving a wife with no child, the man shall marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. There were seven brothers. The first married, and when he died, left no children. And the second married her and died, leaving no children. And the third likewise. None of the seven left children. Last of all, the woman herself died. In the resurrection, whose wife will she be? For the seven had married her. Jesus said to them, is not this the reason you are wrong, that you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God? For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for the dead being raised, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the story about the bush, how God said to him, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is God not of the dead, but of the living. You are quite wrong. The Gospel of Christ.
Back in 1994, when Wanda and I were married for just 2 years, fresh out of Bible college, and went to my first church in Regina, Saskatchewan, Southside Pentecostal Assembly, I was there to be the youth and music pastor, and shortly after arriving, I made acquaintance with the youth pastor of the other Pentecostal church in Regina in the north, Avonhurst Pentecostal Assembly, a guy named Randy Clark. And so Randy and I started to get to know each other because we figured we'd be working closely together at some point, but also expanded our circle of influence and circle of friends with other youth pastors from other churches and other denominations in the area. And so a bunch of us got together. We wanted to plan some big youth event in Regina. But, you know, as you do, you kind of connect and catch up and see how everybody is doing. And Randy had just had the birth of his first child. And so, as you might expect, this proud father has a bunch of pictures in his wallet. And so someone asked him, hey, how's that new kid of yours? Oh, man, he's great. And so he's passing around the pictures of his new child and everything. And then there was another guy who had just had a kid, too, a little bit earlier. And so they're showing pictures of their child and so on. But then they turned to this other guy and said, well, what about you, Rob? Have you got any children yet? And he said, no, they're still in my loins. And then without missing a beat, Randy said, and I don't want to see any pictures. But the idea that we were able to laugh at Rob's response, they're still in my loins, is speaking to, of course, this biblical image of how human procreation was understood. We talk a lot about how in the Bible, in particular in the Hebrew Bible, that it is a patriarchal society, it's focused on men in leadership and so on, but I don't know if you've ever noticed that it's kind of curious that when you read a genealogy in the text, it's always the guy who is producing somebody. You know, Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat 12 kids by 4 women, you know, but it was always the man doing the begetting. How is that supposed to work? Is it just because the Bible is favoring men and decide that the lineage should go through him rather than through the women? Well, not quite, though that certainly is part of the upshot to it. But the understanding they had back then, 3,000 years ago, even 2,000 years ago, about human procreation, was that anybody who was to be a child to a couple already resided within the man. The man is the one who had his seed, and the seed contained the offspring of his lineage. And so, continuing with the agricultural metaphor then, all that has to happen is the seed needs to be planted that it can then produce. And so the woman was generally then seen as the field in which the man would plant his seed. And if the seed's planted and doesn't grow, that means there's something wrong with the field. And when you plant fields and they don't grow, they're referred to as barren. When we talk about a barren wasteland over there or this barren field over here, and soon the language was applied to women. Women that could not have children were said to be barren. There is no concept of male impotence in the scriptures. It's always a problem with the field. The woman is barren. And in that ancient culture, the thing that a woman was designed to do was produce children. So if you could not have children, that was something that was shameful. It was something that would cause you great upset. It would be something that you would long to have be different about you. And in the Hebrew Bible, we are told stories of 6 women in particular who are said to be barren, unable to produce children for their man. There are also references to other women in general who could not produce children, but 6 in particular are named. We have Sarah, the wife to Abraham, who we read about today from Genesis chapter 17, 18, and 21. We got quite a package of reading this morning. There's Sarah, and then their son Isaac, his wife Rebekah also was said to be barren and could not have children. And then their child Jacob, his favorite wife Rachel, was also said to be barren and could not bear children. And then there are three more. The wife of Manoah. We're not even given her name, just that her husband's name is Manoah. She was barren, but then she was able to bear a child, and Samson was born to her, this great strong hero in the time of the judges. And then Hannah was not able to have children, and when she called out to God, God responded and opened her womb, and she was able to give birth to Samuel, who became this first significant prophet in the history of Israel, who anointed Saul and David as the kings over Israel. And then there is one more woman, a Shunammite woman, associated with Elisha. And if I remember correctly, she was unable to have children. She went to Elisha. Elisha prayed, and now she could have a kid. And then shortly after that, her son died, and she's going, what? Like, he answered a prayer, and now it's gone. Anyway, that whole episode was the sixth one. So this pattern of barrenness, this pattern of being unable to produce children, is one that crops up from time to time in the scripture. Now, in our gospel reading today, we took an excerpt from the Gospel of Mark, and here the Sadducees are trying to give Jesus a hard time, and they don't believe in the sense of a resurrection like the Jews did believe back then, and so they're playing a game with Jesus. Yeah, this woman married seven guys, and you know, none of them produced kids. You know, whose wife is she going to be in the resurrection? And Jesus sidesteps their whole argument, and he makes this interesting point. He says, don't you remember from Exodus chapter 3 when Moses is confronted by the burning bush and he asks, who is speaking to me? God says, I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And the point being made there that Jesus is drawing out is that God is saying, this is who I am, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And understand, these guys were already dead, right? But the point that God would define Godself that way, Jesus is saying, is to say that God is not the God of dead people, but that in some way Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob indeed live. But the other thing that comes up in that phrase is this term, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, comes up several times in the scriptures to point to the significance of these three men that are known as the patriarchs of Israel. There's Father Abraham, who is honored by Jews and Christians and Muslims because Abraham's son Ishmael is the one who ultimately would become the father of the Arabs, and then from that would come Islam. But he also was the father of Isaac. And we saw in the reading that this idea of Abraham having children was a promise that was given to him, actually 25 years earlier. And he was promised, you would have a son, I'm going to make you a great nation, and I'm going to give you a land. And about halfway through the 25 years that Abraham had to wait, he was a little impatient, as was his wife, and she said, look, it's not working for me, I'm not producing a kid for you here, sleep with my handmaid instead, and maybe she can produce a child for you. And sure enough, he has a child with her, and that's who Ishmael is. But then God comes back in this passage and says, look, you are going to have a son through your wife, Sarah. And when Abraham hears that news, he laughs. Are you kidding me? We've been trying for ages. It doesn't work. And she's like 90 now. And as it said in a poetic way here, Sarah, it had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. That's a euphemistic way of saying she's postmenopausal now, right? You know, like Abraham's laughing at this whole idea. How is this supposed to happen? It's just not likely. But God reiterates, no, this will happen. About this time next year, you will have a son by Sarah. And then in the next chapter, Sarah is the one who's confronted with this reality. And when she overhears that she's supposed to have a child, she responds in the same way. She laughs. How is it that I'm supposed to be able to give birth to a child? After I have grown old and my husband is old, shall I have pleasure? And the idea just boggles her mind. And then, of course, we hear that somehow God calls her on it. How come you laughed? I didn't laugh. No, you really laughed. And we get this picture of the impossibility that Abraham and Sarah should be able to have a child, especially through Sarah. Now, there is one thing really curious about this, by the way. In Genesis chapter 17, the first part that we read, when Abraham is told this, he laughs to himself and he says, can a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Sounds like a ridiculous proposition, doesn't it? Until you go back to Genesis chapter 5, When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of Seth. When Seth had lived 105 years, he became the father of Enosh. When Jared had lived 162 years, he became the father of Enoch. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he became the father of Lamech. When Lamech had lived 182 years, he became the father of Noah. And Noah was 500 years old when he had his sons Ham, Shem, and Japheth. It's like, were they not paying attention? Except, however, those chapters of the Bible would not have been written at the time of Abraham and Sarah. And so there wouldn't have been any concept of that timing. So we would share our same incredulity with them. How can a 100-year-old man and a 90-year-old postmenopausal woman give birth to a child? But nevertheless, they did. The story is told that Isaac was indeed born to them. And the interesting thing is that Isaac's name means laughter. And so Abraham is told this is going to happen, he laughs. Sarah is told this is going to happen, she laughs. And then they're told, yeah, you're going to name the kid Laughter. And then when the child is born, sure enough, they name him Laughter. And then Sarah says, God has brought laughter for me. God has brought Isaac for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And it's like there's this big almost joke about this whole situation. And it becomes unforgettable to the people who hear the story, which is, of course, the point of why this was written, right? The scriptures began being written in about 1000 BCE, when Israel was now a kingdom, had rest from war. They could tell their backstory and describe who their God is and how they related to God and what the character of God, Yahweh, the God of Israel, was. And this becomes a significant part of the story. Abraham, the great patriarch, was unable to produce children, and yet Yahweh said, you are going to have a child through your son Sarah, I guarantee it, and this will be the one through whom more descendants will come. Well, so then Isaac marries Rebekah, and Rebekah is barren as well. Now, it's a very short description in the book of Genesis about this episode, but God is appealed to, Yahweh is asked to make a difference, and Yahweh opens Rebekah's womb, and she is able to have children. She's pregnant with twins, Jacob and Esau. And when they're born, we end up seeing that there's conflict right from the get-go, but the younger son, Jacob, is the one who ends up being the one to carry on this covenant, this promise, this blessing that God had given Abraham. Jacob's name gets changed to Israel, and he ends up having, as I alluded to earlier, 12 kids with four women. But the important thing here is his favorite wife, the wife he worked so long for, and that's a whole story in itself, Rachel was unable to have children. She was barren as well. And then finally, she was able to give birth to two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And Joseph is the one who ends up getting sold into slavery in Egypt, which enables the family of the Israelites, about 70 people, to be spared from death because of famine, because they could come into Egypt and they could live and thrive and prosper. And the nation of Israel, the descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, are saved and they become a great nation. The point of this story is that the patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all were the ones through whom the nation of Israel came, and it was absolutely impossible for Israel to even exist if it wasn't for the intervention and intentional action of Yahweh. The point of this story, the point of the book of Genesis, you could even say, is to highlight the fact that for the readers 1,000 years before the time of Jesus, could read this and go, oh my goodness, if it wasn't for Yahweh, we wouldn't even exist. Because it was impossible for Sarah to have kids. And Rebekah wasn't going to be able to have kids. And Rachel wasn't going to be able to give birth to the one who ultimately saved us by taking us into the plentiful nation of Egypt so that we could all live. The only way Israel could exist, this story is saying, is because God intended it to be so. And so as a result, the readers of this passage, the readers of this book, the ancient Israelites in the time of the monarchy, get to understand, yeah, we need to pay attention to Yahweh. There's a reason why we should worship Yahweh and no other God. We are indeed Yahweh's chosen people because we would not exist whatsoever if it wasn't for Yahweh's intention for us to be there. Now, if this was a Bible college class, that would be lovely. Hey, look what we've learned today, and this is great. But then the question always comes, so what do we do with this? Because knowing something cool about the ancient literature that is the Bible and learning something about how the story of Israel is being shaped is fascinating on its own. But from our Christian perspective, we look to this book to understand, is there something we can draw or learn from or gather that we can put into practice here? Well, perhaps the obvious lesson from this would be to say, well, God made a promise, and even though it took 25 years until it happened, because Abraham was 75 when the promise was first given, and he was 100 when Isaac was born, God nevertheless keeps his promises. Maybe we have to wait for a while, but that seems like a really easy lesson to draw from and to draw out of this passage. But I wonder if there might even be more things that we could discover. And here is where I'm going to leave you unsatisfied. Yes. Yes. Sorry, Mary, I am. Because here's the thing. As we go through the narrative lectionary, we are learning what the grand story is that we find throughout the Hebrew Bible and into the New Testament and then ostensibly beyond, as we are set on a trajectory that we've been following for the past couple thousand years in Christian history. But even before the time of Jesus, in just a couple hundred years before Jesus arrived, the Jewish rabbis, looking at the Hebrew texts, realized even then that these were ancient stories about an ancient people, right? It started being written 1,000 years earlier. The time of Abraham would have been about 2,000 years before the time of Jesus. So the rabbis are reading this and going, okay, we can read this ancient picture and we get the idea about how things got started and all of that. But as we read more about what Israel experienced and what they did and traveling through the wilderness and dealing with the period of the judges, like all of that is way, 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 way past tense. And the rabbis would labor to understand what can these ancient texts about an ancient people that we are quite different from now, what can we learn from these scriptures? And so rabbinic interpretation of the Hebrew Bible would endeavor to see what is it that we can draw from this? How can we learn from this ancient text? And in a similar way, that is exactly what we are doing, now 4,000 years removed from the time of Abraham, 3,000 years removed from when the scriptures first started being written, 2,000 years removed from the time of Jesus, and we are looking to these texts, endeavoring to see how can it speak to us. The reason I'm going to leave you unsatisfied is because that's where this sermon is going to end now. I've given you one idea of what it is we might learn from this episode of Abraham and Sarah and the promise of Isaac being born. But if there's something else to draw from that, I'm leaving that with you. Or perhaps our conversation about this sermon after coffee at noon today, if you want to join for that conversation. This is our task as we read the Hebrew Bible. How is it that we can find this ancient text, painting a picture, giving us a lesson, providing some kind of guidance, some kind of wisdom for how it is that we live today, so far removed from when it was first written? This is what makes reading the Bible and exploring it over the course of our lives so rewarding and beneficial, and also why we need a community with which to do it. And so, that's where this ends. The ball is in your court. And as we continue to explore this narrative down through the next number of weeks and months, I trust that you'll always have an ear open yourselves. What do I get out of this? And we'll see what we can come together with as we discuss it. Amen.